Good morning, and may God be with each of you. It's been a rich time so far this morning. I'd like to especially just highlight a few of the things that Brother Sam mentioned from Psalm 145 that ministered to me. The Lord is good to all, and He is full of compassion. The Lord is faithful to all His promises. The Lord is near to those who call on Him. That is so rich and so powerful, and I appreciate that. Well, this feels conspicuously new, and I debated about making specific mention of that or not, but I guess I would just say what I've said before, actually kind of echoing what Brother Sam said too this morning. This church has given so much to me, continues to give so much to me. I owe an awful lot of where I am to this body here. Of course, it's changed over the last 42 years, but I owe an awful lot of where I am to this group, and if I have this opportunity to give back to the group, I do so joyfully. I want to be a builder. You can turn to Acts 17. That's where we'll be going eventually here. I've been musing for a while now about the differences in the ways that we as humans think or process and how we communicate. You know, it's fascinating to watch those little gears turning in the minds of young children and to recognize how differently they operate from adults. We find that interesting, but not particularly troublesome. What I think we do find, let's just say there are a multitude of other differences that we don't see as readily, nor are we as comfortable in dealing with these differences as we are with the differences with the differences in the way we think and the differences in the way children think. Think, for example, about the differences in the general way that, say, men and women think. Or how about the way a person with an administrative bent processes a problem on the job compared to the way somebody who's has the research and development mindset approaches the problem. The administrator may be thinking, what can we do to get this crew up and running as soon as possible here? And the research and development guy may be thinking more, I wonder what we could do, what kind of solution we can put together to avoid this problem next time. But I think we're even a little more comfortable with those differences than we are with some differences that I think are more foundational and harder to wrap our minds around. In the last several decades, experts tell us that we have moved from what they call the modern era to the postmodern era. We may tend to dismiss this as just some kind of experts talking, but I do have to acknowledge that I have observed a significant shift in the way the postmodern generation processes life and issues and truth, etc. I can't explain it, but I do think that I view life through lenses that are in some ways more like my father, who is 80 years old, 80 plus, than I do like, say, 20-year-olds, even though I'm toward the younger end of that spectrum. It's not that I don't have a lot in common with most of the 20-year-olds, say, in this congregation. There is simply a difference somehow in some of the ways that we think that doesn't really show up in everyday conversation because we have so much in common. We share the same language. A lot of us grew up in the same region geographically and politically, of course, and we have, in many cases, similar backgrounds and similar sets of current circumstances. But there is a difference there, I think. And I think there are some other differences between U.S. natives, people from the U.S., from different parts of the country. That's maybe not as significant, but I think I've seen some of that. However, I think where the differences get pretty perplexing is when we're talking about U.S. natives or longtime residents of the U.S. and people of other cultures and countries. The differences in the way we view time and relationships, money or possessions, and the way we live out our faith, the way we handle conflicts, these differences increase as we get further, in many cases actually geographically, from our own culture. An example of this, I believe, is in the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's known as one of the most devastating acts of war of all time. A significant number of people who have studied this situation suspect that the decision to drop the bomb may have resulted from a misunderstanding. 6 days before the attack, the U.S. had issued to Japan a demand to surrender. It seems that Japan's response may have actually been more, we're thinking about it, but the U.S. read it as, we won't surrender, and proceeded with its plans to drop the bombs. So, why should these differences in thinking and processing and communicating interest us? I can think of a number of reasons, but probably first and maybe foremost is that there are indeed right ways of thinking and communicating, and there are in fact wrong ways of thinking and communicating. Further, all of our interactions, family, church, community, and beyond, are characterized by and built on our communications. The goal of communication is to help the other person or entity understand what we are trying to convey. And that communication hasn't succeeded if the other entity doesn't understand that, what we are trying to say. Even if you think very much like I do, there are still several translations that need to happen before you can understand what I am understanding or meaning. First of all, my thought has to be translated into converted into a language. Then that message has to go either, it has to be transmitted from me to you, and that can be a problem if you have a mush in your mouth like I tend to have, or if your handwriting is not too legible like mine tends to not be. Next, that message has to enter your brain either through your eyes or your ears, and there are of course limitations in that. And finally, that message has to be translated from the words to how you think. And so there are already a number of glitches in that, potential glitches in how we process just between people who think much alike. Now, how about if we add to that you translate from English to Spanish, or even worse, to Chinese or to Hindi? So why should we care? It's because all of our efforts at making family or church work are dependent on successful communication. And what is the commission we've been given? It's to go and to make disciples of all nations and to teach them. Somebody has said, and I agree, that teaching hasn't really happened until learning has occurred. So I'd like to spend some time now, beyond today, in a series of messages examining the way we think and how it impacts the way we communicate and the way we understand truth and each other and life in general. Now, I'm pretty inept with titles here, but since I have to come up with something, I guess I'm calling this an inquiry into thinking and communication. Sorry, that's all I can come up with here. As a starting point now, let's move to Acts 17. This is a slightly cross-cultural interaction. It's from the life of the early church, and I see it as both strategic and very ingenious in the way Paul handled this. We'll actually start reading in verse 16, but let me just make a few introductory comments. The chapter takes place during Paul's second missionary journey, He had just spent about 3 weeks in Thessalonica, that's in the first section of this chapter, before being forced to leave from there. And from there he went to Berea, the people we now have marked for their hunger for the word. Verse 11 says, "These were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the scriptures daily, whether those things were so." If you check your maps, you will see that from here, Paul goes about 200 miles south along the coast and comes in around into a bay, it looks like, to Athens. And that's where verse 16 picks up. I might just also mention that Paul is alone here. He's kind of in a holding pattern waiting for Silas and Timothy. So we'll read now from verse 16 to the end of the chapter. "While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, 'What is this babbler trying to say?' Others remarked, 'He seems to be advocating foreign gods.' They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, 'May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean.' All the Athenians and foreigners who spent their time there," let me read that again, "all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, 'Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious.'" Notice this is a little different rendering than the King James, where it says "too superstitious." I think, from what I was reading, this is perhaps a little closer to Paul's meaning, was to say very religious, because they were obviously worshiping a lot of idols. Verse 23, "For I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship. I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the times set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. Sorry, not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead." When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, "We want to hear you again on this subject." At that, Paul left the council. A few men became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. Now let me just pick up in verse 17. It mentions here that the term that the King James uses, devout persons. The NIV, let me just say that in the Greek, the descriptor there actually means literally "those who worship." But some other translations render this "God-fearing Gentiles" or Greeks. And a number of commentators concur that this is probably what was intended. Now, this passage contains several references to ancient Greek culture and the city of Athens that I believe merit some further elaboration. Verse 17 mentions the marketplace. And that's where Paul, well, Paul went to two places initially, to the synagogue on the Sabbath and to the marketplace. This marketplace in the Greek is called agora. And let me just quote from stoa.org on this. The agora, the marketplace and civic center, was one of the most important parts of an ancient city of Athens. In addition to being a place where people gathered to buy and sell all kinds of commodities, it was also a place where people assembled to discuss all kinds of topics: business, politics, current events, or the nature of the universe and the divine. Now, in verse 19, he mentions another place. This is the Areopagus. This was a judicial body that met on Mars Hill, which was adjacent to the Agora on the south. Now, this assumes that the Agora mentioned here was the Greek Agora, because the Roman Agora was actually somewhere else. The Areopagus was actually the model of fair judgment, and that is evidenced from a quote also from an ancient Greek. Let me read this quote to you. It's from stoa.org. The name I'm going to guess at, it looks like Aeschines maybe, said, "Take the example of the Council of Areopagus, the most scrupulous tribunal in the city. I myself have before now seen many men convicted before this tribunal, though they spoke most eloquently and presented witnesses, and I know that before now certain men have won their case, although they spoke most feebly and had no witnesses testified for them. And although no witnesses testified for them. For it is not on the strength of the pleading alone, nor of the testimony alone, that the members of the court give their verdict, but on the strength of their own knowledge and their own investigations. And this is the reason why that tribunal maintains its high repute in the city." Now, by the first century AD, I understand the Areopagus was primarily a court that tried homicide. So whether or not Paul was being judged criminally here isn't clear to me, but Adam Clark quotes indirectly Virgil and indicates that under Roman law, it was a capital offense to introduce any new god to the state. It does seem clear from several references given later in the passage that he was actually meeting before that he was given an official audience before this court. Verse 33. The Greek says literally, "departed from them," where I read in the NIV, "at that Paul left the council." It does seem that many translators kind of render it as such, leaving the council, leaving the midst of them, indicating that it was an official meeting of the Areopagus. Now notice verse 34, which I think also underscores this point. Dionysius was a member of the Areopagus. King James says he was an Areopagite. So Dionysius heard as a member of the Areopagite, and amazingly, he believed. Now that in itself is a noteworthy situation, but I'll come back to that a little bit later. Now, let's go back to verse 18 and 21. Here, Athens is clearly depicted as a center of learning and discussion about new ideas, particularly in the area of philosophy. The extra-biblical record confirms this. Barnes Biblical Help quotes, here's another name I don't know, Merciless, maybe, as saying that there were more than 300 places in Athens where students of philosophy and other interested citizens could gather to discuss issues of current interest. Now, quoting from Vincent's Word Studies about this habit of the Athenians from verse 21, where he says, "doing nothing," where it's, they spent all their time doing nothing else but either to tell or to hear of some new thing. Here's what Vincent's Word Studies says: "Their own orators and poets lashed them for this peculiarity. Aristophanes styled Athens the city of gapers. Demades says that the crest, or which is the coat of arms, today we'd call it a logo, of Athens ought to be a great tongue. Demosthenes asked them, is it all your care to go up and down the market asking each other, is there any news? In the speech of Cleon to the Athenians, given by Thucydides, he says, "No men are better dupes, sooner deceived by novel notions, or slower to follow approved advice. You despise what is familiar, while you are worshippers of every new extravagance. You are always hankering after an ideal state, but you do not give your minds even to what is straight before you. In a word, you are at the mercy of your own ears." Now, how would you like to jump into this hotbed of academic latest and greatest with a new idea that will probably not be popular among all the other latest and greatest ideas? Now, we have one more fascinating reference in verse 23 that I'd like to point out to you here. This is where Paul mentions in his sermon the altar to the unknown God. Commentators and historians generally agree that Paul was abbreviating the inscription. The inscription probably actually read, "To the gods of Asia, Europe, and Libya," or Africa, "to the unknown and strange God." There is not as general agreement about whether only one altar like this existed, at least in Athens, but there were clearly, there were probably more than one altars in Greece to the unknown God. Barnes Bible Notes quotes from an ancient Greek document, "Here was a remarkable altar raised in Athens in a time of pestilence in honor of the unknown God which had granted them deliverance." Diogenes Laertius says that Epimedes restrained the pestilence in the following manner, quote, "Taking white and black sheep, he led them to the Areopagus and there permitted them to go where they would, commanding those who followed them to sacrifice to the God to whom these things pertained, or who had the power of averting the plague, whoever he might be, without adding the name, and thus to allay the pestilence. From which it has arisen that at this day, through the villages of the Athenians, altars are found without any name." From the reading I did, this seems to be the likely explanation for the origin of this altar. I don't know, but I can only imagine that Paul may have been familiar with that history. I don't know that. It's interesting that he ties that to the unknown God being Jehovah God. Now, Don Richardson, whom I have read some in respect, believes that Paul was actually alluding to the prominent Greek concept of a first cause, or another term, another way of saying it is a causeless cause, or unmoved mover. This concept was actually advanced by Aristotle maybe 400 years before this, and I find it interesting how the Greeks' careful logic brought them this close to an acknowledgement of one supreme being. Now, I can't find any textual evidence, actually, for the way that I remember Paul to be, Don Richardson, to be defending that. If my memory is correct, he said that the Greeks used theos to refer to this unknown God and used some other term, maybe it was deos or something, to refer to these other gods. Well, actually, in the New Testament, all the plural uses of the word, all the plural uses gods, are translated from the same word, theos. So I don't see the evidence for that there. By the way, that theos is the one place where gods is not translated from this word is in verse 18, I believe. No, a little bit later. It's where he says it is verse 18. He seems to be advocating foreign or strange gods. And that word, by the way, is diamonos, diamonion, or something like that. And that's the word that is translated demons or devils in the New Testament typically. So that was the one case where the plural gods is not theos. So, I don't see the evidence there, meaning that they recognize this unknown God as being the one true God, but that does not mean that the Greek philosophers listening didn't make that connection between what Paul was proposing and their concept of this causeless cause. Let me elaborate just a little bit using Aristotle's explanation and listen to the logic of this. Aristotle, I'm quoting from Wikipedia basically here, Aristotle said basically this: there exists movement in the world, and things that move were set in motion by something else. So, if everything that moves were caused to move by something else, there would be an infinite chain of causes, and that can't happen. Thus, there must have been something else that caused that first movement. Now, by implication, that first movement cannot itself ever have been moved. So there must have been an unmoved mover. Now, that's kind of a complex logic, but it is very straightforward logic. And the Greeks were using that to explain that, well, there's got to be something behind all this. Some non-cause cause. And I think that Paul could very readily have tapped into that and had these philosophers connecting with that in his message here. Now I plan on digging into the sermon itself a little bit later in another message, but let me just make one final note here from the last verse 34, and I'll kind of use this as a launching into what I'll call a take-home section. I mentioned this earlier that Dionysius was the Areopagite, or a member of the judicial body here, the Areopagus. Given the context of this sermon, after all we've just talked about I was going to say the secularity, the secular nature, but they weren't really secular in the sense that they didn't worship gods, but it was still a really pagan culture there in Athens. Given that context, are you as surprised as I am that somebody of Dionysius' position to get involved in this controversial sect? He had a lot to lose. In his position on the Areopagus, was supposed to be a lifetime position, and so unless he did something unworthy, he was there for life, and that was a real honor. And if indeed Paul was coming under fire for advocating foreign gods, Dionysius would have been running the same risk. Notice that just before this, a part of the audience essentially quit listening when Paul mentioned the resurrection of the dead. This didn't fit neatly into their Greek thought, even though they were always open to new ideas. That, too, I think would have been a big hurdle for Dionysius. Now, just to get a little personal here, with the odds that Paul was up against, how eager would you have been to jump in and start talking? These people, both the philosopher crowd in the marketplace and the judging body on the Areopagus, they were not really on Paul's wavelength. And they certainly don't look to me like the kind of audience that is simply going to hang on to every word and hungrily and say, you know, this is just what we've been looking for. We've been waiting for the Messiah. That's not the kind of crowd he had here. I'm thinking that this scene really isn't that much different than a scene 2,000 years later, namely the academic scene in the current U.S., probably elsewhere too, Europe for sure. We've grown accustomed to people, at least here in the U.S., we've grown accustomed to people being open to almost any new idea or proposal as long as it doesn't step on their toes, as long as it doesn't really meddle with their business. So I think you can see where this is going. And frankly, a part of me wishes that the primary application in this passage wouldn't be evangelism. I'm not very good at doing what Paul did here. And frankly, I don't enjoy that kind of a jump in confrontative approach in a potentially hostile environment. Although I don't do this nearly as much as I should, I don't nearly as much mind getting involved in people's lives one-on-one, or family to family, that kind of thing. And make no mistake, I'm defending that. I think that's a positive and effective way of drawing people closer to the kingdom of God. But if Paul jumped into a group discussion here in this unlikely venue, and if he met with some success, then I guess I can't dismiss out of hand the possibility that God may want me to get myself in the same situation. You know, it wouldn't be hard. All I would have to do is do what Josh McDowell does, among others. He holds public meetings on secular college and university campuses where the lust for power and knowledge and illicit relationships rules the lives of students and faculty. I could do that here in Hutchinson, actually. And I could do that on probably 20 campuses within 2 hours driving distance of here. Now, you notice I said it wouldn't be hard. Well, let me say that a little differently. The opportunities would be hard to miss. It would be hard for me. So then why is it that I don't tap into these opportunities more often? Well, the reasons are obvious. I have a full-time job, I have a young family, and I'm heavily involved in my church here. Aren't those reasons enough? We all know the answer. Most of us can't and shouldn't quit our jobs or dismiss our family responsibilities or our involvement in the church. But all of us can be a little more thoughtful about moving direct confrontative evangelism activities or witnessing a little higher on our list of priorities, or dare I say, on our to-do list. I think you might disagree with me on this, balance me out, but I think our church is a lot more comfortable with discipleship kinds of activities. It's work, but it's not nearly as hard when the people are coming to us wanting to learn. I certainly am, and I don't want to minimize this. But the Great Commission unmistakably implies that disciples are made from people who start out as unbelievers. Let me read Romans 10, 14 through 15. How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach except they be sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings of good things. Some of you do much better at this than I do. The youth group has a vision for this, and they have actually made it the focus of their retreat this year. Now I have a confession to make. Michael asked me this week if I would consider talking about evangelism next weekend at the retreat. I told him that I would consider it, but I also told him that Dwight is actually in a better position to talk about this than I am, because he has had more experience in the subject, I think. Now, I don't have any problem with having Dwight being better at this than I am. But I don't think I should have an excuse for not being able to talk about it at the retreat because I don't have enough experience. So how do we process this? It's clear to me, as I mentioned before, that we don't simply drop everything we're doing and run out and start witnessing to people. That's not a long-term solution. But I think we have two obligations here. I think we need to find ways to weave this into the course of our everyday lives. How do we do that? It varies. And for some of us, I think our jobs make that a little more difficult than others. Rightly or wrongly, I found it easier to do this when I was doing construction work than I do when I'm talking on the phone with people at Golden Rule. But there is a way to do it. And there are some of you who do so very effectively. I could start highlighting some of the cases I know, but then I'm sure I'd leave some people out. I think I'll risk it and just mention one. I know Brother Perry has, for a long time, when people come to his office, just had tracts ready and engaged people in conversation with that. And I remember Brother Ed Yoder's message, that's Janice and Jolene's and Mary Jane's father, in his messages, it seemed like he was always talking about the interactions he had with non-believers and how he would turn the conversation toward eternal issues. So we have to weave it into our everyday life. But the other part that we have to do, I believe, is deliberately block out slots of time in our schedule to make this our focus, to make this our endeavor. That means doing that just like we go to rescue mission, which is actually is actually pretty close to this, but maybe not quite as direct as I think we could get. It means doing the same thing with that as we do with church. You know, we say, okay, we have to start getting ready by so-and-so time so we can leave by so-and-so time so we can be in church. It means making slots in our schedule so that it actually works. I really appreciate what the Hands of Christ Ministry is doing in this regard. I think it is giving us an official way to do this. It's by far not the only way, but I think it is a key way. It gives those of us who, I guess, maybe have been a little unsure about how to start, it gives us a way to start. And there are a lot of other ways as well. It goes without saying, but I'm going to say it anyway, that we can't become Apostle Pauls overnight. But we can at least take incremental steps to becoming more intentional about interacting with non-believers in a way that, as the Jews for Jesus say, that makes the Messiahship of Jesus an unavoidable issue for the people we come in contact with. Let's find ways of stirring each other on to love and good works in the area of evangelism. Let's pray. Lord, occasionally in the last week or weeks, as I've driven through Partridge or encountered people, I've had this thought come to my mind. Unless somebody intervenes, some of these people are going to hell. And that's an uncomfortable thought. It's a thought that I think we as humans can barely deal with because the eternity of hell and the awfulness of the punishment is just mind-boggling. But we want to acknowledge, God, that you have not created hell for humans. That you have instead made a way for us of escape. That you have provided the ultimate sacrifice, the one sacrifice. And Lord, you have made us stewards of this message. I bless you for the example of Paul. And I thank you that he did what isn't comfortable for us, as an example of what can happen. And I ask that you show us how to both weave into the activities of every day and block out special times for this opportunity that we have of drawing people to you by ministering to them with your truth and grace. Mama. In Jesus' name, amen.